Welcome to American Masters, London, NYC, Beyond Broadcast. I'm Susan Lacey, the creator and executive producer of American Masters, and with me is Michael Epstein, the writer and director of London, NYC.
Hi, Susan. Still sounding very sexy?
I'm going to hold on to this as long as I can. Michael, tell us a little something about today's podcast.
Well, today is one of the favorite people that we got an opportunity to meet while we were making London NYC, Earl Slick, who prefers to go by just Slick. Slick was the lead guitarist on Double Fantasy and someone in our shortlist when we started to pull together the film. And for those who don't know, Slick is a New Yorker. He grew up in Staten Island. And he was a great sort of local guitar player and then eventually got into the David Bowie orbit, went on tour with David Bowie, and then performed on Young Americans and Station to Station, played on Stay, which is a great song and I think his big claim to fame, and met John supposedly on the Young American sessions, because that's when John and David Bowie wrote Fame together. Although, as you'll hear in the podcast, Slick has no memory of that particular moment. And then he was brought in to Double Fantasy by Jack Douglas, who had every intention of trying to dirty up the sessions because he wanted something more than just regular studio musicians for John. So he played along with John and Hugh McCracken, who also is in our documentary. Earl Slick. And depending on how everything goes, you may want to have a moment to turn this podcast off if there are children present. Fair parental warning that Slick
is a rock and roller.
He's a rock and roller. That's a good way to put it. He's a rock and roller.
And you can't take rock and roll out of the boy.
Yeah, so some of the language is not family friendly. It's not, none of it's too bad, but certainly if you are worrying about curse words, I would suggest you turn the podcast off remove the kids from the room. But here you go, Earl Slick.
And there are only a couple more podcasts to go before this series ends, and we need your questions, which we will answer after the broadcast of London NYC. And join us next week when our podcast will be our interview with Klaus Voormann, a dear friend of John's dating all the way back to the Beatles days in Hamburg and a great bass guitar player on so many of John's songs, and a terrific, terrific interview. And be sure to tune in on November 22nd to American Masters on your local PBS station to see London NYC. And to find out even more, check out our website, www.pbs.org/AmericanMasters.
What do you like in the studio if you're working on someone else's album? What's the, you know, the setup or the vibe that, you know, you think, I love this producer is doing, I love what this artist is doing, what's the thing that makes the most sense? Or does it change with everybody, so it's like impossible?
No, there's a definite rule here.
What's the rule?
If I walk in a room and I've got a confident artist and a confident producer that know what they want and they know how to do it, and they know that the people that they brought in to do it are there to sort of fill in the pieces of that puzzle. In other words, you have two guitarists. You have one guitarist that has this style and one that has that style. You know, and you know that you've gotten the right drummer. They've done all this. If you're doing a record where they're bringing in, because I haven't done much of that because I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool session player, but, you know, in the case of Double Fantasy, I mean, we had the top session guys around in there, and here was me. Couldn't read music, didn't get it, didn't do sessions, but they wanted me in there, and there I was. And it was a big joke about me always taking the sheet music and flying across the room because I didn't understand any of it. So,
well, that's the thing. Right?
I watched John.
How so?
I listened to the chords he was playing, and I played them. And then we would discuss back and forth. That's what I like, discussing back and forth with the artist. I don't like being spoken to third person by a producer through the artist.
Because you're not. That delicate politic dance.
It's weird.
Right. Well, give me
some
sense.
You know, would somebody tell the guy over in the corner to play an E chord? You know, it takes a little something out of it.
Exactly. What the fuck am I doing here?
Exactly. Why am I here?
Right.
And there was a off camera later, I got a good one for you.
Okay. Well, give me some sense of that dynamic, because, you know, Jack said, you know, you were kind of like thrown in there to, like, you know, not mess things up. That's not the right thing, but to, you know, dirty it up a little bit.
I was the edgy street kid, and these were the guys who made lots of records. I mean, Huey had already done, like, Simon and Garfunkel records and stuff. And Tony had, I mean, these guys have done a lot of sessions. You know, at that point, I'd had solo record contracts. I mean, the person I'd worked with the most up to that point was a David Bowie band member. And that was brought in to dirty that up, too. You know, just give it a little bit of a, almost a Stonesy edge to what it is, because that's where I come from.
Right.
You know, as much as of a Beatle fan as I am, a lot of my demeanor as a player comes more from the Rolling Stones. And I found out by playing with John Lennon that his rhythm guitar playing is actually not that far off from Keith's.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Irreverent, chunky, all feel. And he banged that guitar, and I didn't realize that till I got in a room with him, because what you hear on the record, on a Beatle record, has been produced and polished and put together a certain way. You could start hearing John's guitar playing a lot more on his solo albums, like Step On, you know, the Cold Turkey and all of that.
Right, New York City, you hear it.
Oh yeah, you definitely hear it. And it's definitely a dirty, irreverent guitar style.
All right, so what job?
I'm Losing You, for instance, right? There's a bunch of parts going on in there, but it really is a... John was playing something like that in that loose, you know, and then I picked up another simpler line, but when John got to the chunky bits, which is all it's very slowed down Chuck Berry, dirty slowed down Chuck Berry is what that is. And that's what creates the mood. And I'm a dirt player. That's dirt. John played the same way.
You know, he never got far from that 50s rock.
Oh, it was always in there.
He's always in that playground.
Yeah.
That's what he loves. That's what he's comfortable with. So how did you guys find your rhythm? How did you guys communicate then? Because presumably that's the first thing you're trying to hear.
Because John would he came in well prepared with the songs as far as the form went, you know, the lyrics and melodies and basic chord changes, and some of them he had a rhythmic idea, but he would just start playing maybe something, and then Slicky add something to that, Huey add something to that, you know, and the three of us would play it, and then all of a sudden, bang, it would gel, and then that would be the rhythm guitar part.
And you all would know at the same time that it had gelled, or John would hear something?
Sometimes it would be him and Huey that would gel. Sometimes it would be me and John that would gel. Sometimes it would be me and Huey that would gel. You know what I mean? And once two got on the thing, then we'd figure a third part for the third guy. You know, because normally you wouldn't do three identical parts, even though I'm sure it would have happened.
So he seems very loose in the studio, right?
Yes.
Give me some sense of is that typical? Is that a unique thing?
It was very balanced because it was loose in terms of, from my perception, is that if I was not really going with the flow, but going against the flow, or off in my own world, John would actually take that off in my own world thing and make something out of it, as opposed to other artists or producers more looking at that as a mistake. He would look at it like, well, that mistake you just made is kind of cool. Let's turn it into a part, you know. And it was loose. Work was work, though. I mean, you know, we had work to do, and it had to be done. But to get the work done, you needed to have a happy family in there. And a happy family is not one that's got some 5'4" dictator crazy producer running around barking orders at everybody.
Right. Well, you know, and I would imagine you can never get that far from the fact, yes, it's work, but it's also art. and you got to have the happy accent.
Yes. So
somebody's sitting there telling you, play, you know, play this exactly this way. And
yeah.
Don't ever deviate. Well, you're never going to, there's going to be no life.
And, but you know what? There are some times where that needs to be done. But then there's, like, in other words, there are certain parts that need to be played a certain way. But there's ways to get that across, and there's ways to not get that across. Simple as that.
All right, so let me... Jack tells a very funny story of rehearsals. Were you part of the rehearsals at the earliest stage, or did you come...
I came in at Hit Factory on day one of that band, after Cheap Trick had already been and gone.
Okay. So, day one, Cheap Trick has come and gone. And Jack says, you know, he wants to experiment. John's like, all right, we'll do it. But John was, that's not the voice that John, that's not where John's head is at, right? Can you talk to me about, not the personalities of the guys, because I think everybody got along, but just the sound? Because, you know, I've heard the Cheap Trick version of I'm Losing You,
mm-hmm.
and then the version that was on Double Fantasy. Well, how do they, have you, you listened to both, mm-hmm. presumably?
Cheap Trick's version sounds like Cheap Trick. Because they were a band, and they got, you know, they're one of those few bands that came out of that period that actually have a band sound and identity, which, you know, they think all, only new bands don't have identity. Go all the way back to the beginning. There's been thousands of bands that have had no identity, and Cheap Trick was a band that always had an identity to me. They're so distinctive in the way they sound.
Rick's guitar playing has a particular.
Rick's guitar playing, the writing, Robin's voice. The drumming, the eight-string bass playing, the whole thing. It's Cheap. There's no that going, that sounds like Cheap Trick? No, it's Cheap Trick. If it sounds like Cheap Trick, it's Cheap Trick.
Right. So why do you think John didn't want to stick with that experiment?
I wasn't there. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I could have guessed is that maybe it sounded too much like the band Cheap Trick for John. I wasn't there.
So that first day... worked with great people. You're, you know, a musician, an artist in your own right. There's still some trepidation about walking into John Lennon's sessions at all?
I had a case of anxiety that was, like, out of control. I got there, like, an hour and a half early, right? And I figured, okay, there'd be nobody there. It'd give me time to breathe. And everything. Well, guess who was there? John Lennon was there. And I walked in the control room. There's nobody in the control room. And I see a guy sitting in the middle of the room. He's in a chair like this, you know. He's playing something or other. And I see his hair. He lifts up his head. It's John. And I said, oh, shit, John's here. So I go walk in and say hello. And he says, nice to see you again. Really, have we met? I say. He says, yeah, the blah, blah thing and the Young Americans, the David Bowie tracks, and that, and I said, I don't remember. I mean, we're both on these tracks, right? We're both on these songs. And we were going back and forth. It never got resolved. He thinks he met me before, and I'm not sure that I did.
But it's possible?
It's very possible. You could say it was the 70s, and I might have been chemically enhanced at the time. Pretty fucked up to be in a blackout when you finally meet John Lennon, though.
But I'm pretty impressed that he still remembers you, right?
I thought it was great. Yeah. We were laughing about it.
That's the thing, you know, like, you think, like, oh, fuck, it's John Lennon, I've been, you know, there's a couple of guys like that in the world, Nelson Mandela, maybe in politics, John Lennon. But, you know, listening to the outtakes, listening to what Jack's teased out, he's a really funny guy.
Hysterical.
Yeah.
And he would do stuff that nobody else would do. We would be in the middle of a good take, and if all of a sudden he just felt like breaking into some lyric, it would make everybody laugh and make mistakes. He would just do it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was wonderful.
You know, I heard, you know, there's shit of just him ordering sushi and then him breaking into a song about raw fish. There's,
yeah.
You know, we walk around saying slick as sluck. There's a take in, what is it? Which
what?
Which
roulette?
that we've got. But there's a little, you guys are playing, and it'll stop. Hold on, Slick as Sluck. And everybody laughs a little bit.
Wonder what I did.
I don't know. I tried, you know, I'm not enough of a musician to know, but wow. He heard something. And then he was, you know, he liked his having his guitar out of tune a little bit, too, right? I mean, did you find that thing strange? As I'm stepping out, do you remember recording?
Yeah. Matter of fact,
I'm stepping out.
On Stepping Out, it's the only track that ended up later becoming Milk and Honey, okay, where there is a guitar overdub on it. And if I remember correctly, it's... something like that. It's me and John playing it together, face, close to each other. I'll never forget that for as long as I live. And it was an afterthought. I was on my way back to L.A. So I was living in L.A. at the time. And they called me before I split. And they said, John's got an idea. Come back in. And we overdubbed that together. He said, I got this idea, but we have to play it together. And it was on that song.
What do you like listening to on those go back? I mean, I don't know if you're listening to it with Jack now or you listen to the album on its own. What are the pieces of music or a whole song that...
I always still, I still like listening to I'm Losing You, which is a dark one. I like the dark stuff.
It's my favorite.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And then her answer to it, Moving On, which I got to hear the other day as well. And Kiss, 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 because it's so, I mean, that Susie Yonko would let me just, because I had a psycho side of guitar playing and she liked it, so I got to do it on our stuff, which was really a lot of fun.
Well, talk about, the studio sessions, because it's not, this is bad of me. This is not just a John Lennon album. It's a John and Yoko.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you guys are the band for everything. It's not
that's
like
right.
Yoko had her band.
That's right. And you had to treat the songs differently from John's to Yoko's. Yoko's songs were definitely not structured the same way. There were guitar parts that were needed that were going to be definitely on the outside that you couldn't use on John's stuff, which gave me an opportunity to do some of that stuff, which I like doing. From working with Bowie, just some of that outside feedback stuff and things like that, that which you couldn't really hear a feedback line flying all over, just like Starting Over wouldn't work too good. But on Kiss, 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 it works great.
And did she say, hey, Slick, you need something here? I don't know what. She said, it needs exactly this.
It was all...
Or was it open enough?
It was open enough that, it worked this way. It worked that sometimes either she or John had a kind of distinct idea to get you in a direction, or they'd say, what do you think about this? How do you want to approach this? It was around the table.
It sounds very, for a guy who's half of the Beatles, it sounds...
But he liked to be in a band. He didn't want to be... Here's John Lennon. Here's the band. That wasn't the idea. Because he did. That was no fun for him.
Right. And it's not really who he is. I mean, he's the working class hero. He's the
right.
Guy, right? He's the guy that plays for 8 hours or 12 hours on a fucking stage.
Right. Yeah.
Never far from that. I mean, we put him up there.
Well, he is up there in a lot of ways. Because he accomplished something that your average human couldn't do. Period. I mean, where the hell it came from, I know some of the reasons that are logical why, but there was more to it than that. There was something real special going on there, period.
So give me some sense of how you think he found a song in the studio. Jack says that there are times he came in that would have the basic melody now, that he would... The words, you roll around with the words. Did you experience that? How did you guys go from, okay, we're going to start I'm Losing You, or we're going to start I'm Stepping Out, or whatever it is, Watching the Wheels, to, okay, that's it, we got it. Did the lyrics ever change? Did anything change?
Yeah, the lyrics changed. And because I know that some of the lyrics that were being sung on the basic tracks were not exactly the same on the finished you know, or I'm sure, as every songwriter does, does a quick edit at the end to make sure it all makes sense and, you know.
But he still sang the Gaga tracks as if those were going
absolutely.
Down. That's, is that usual?
It was then. Now it's not. You fly it in from across town.
The good old days, right?
Yeah, the good old days. The people actually played music in the same room.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, talk to me about what it was like. You guys weren't all isolated in booths, right?
No, we were in this crowded room full of amps and baffles and shit everywhere. I mean, it was, that's when the Hit Factory, the original one, was tiny. You know, they had John in a booth with an amp and a guitar with a little window in it so you could see him. And then me and Huey were like a little guitar orchestra here with our amps behind us, and Andy Newmark was in the back, and there was baffles all over him. It, keyboard player in the corner, percussion guy over here. We were all in the same room at the same time.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a great thing.
Why?
Because you feed off each other. You look at the guy. Who gives a smirk? Who gives a look? Who's telling a joke in the middle of the take? Or you see, you know, you're not copping the groove and you're watching one of the other guys and all of a sudden you get it. You know, all those things happen. You're being human.
You're having a conversation.
You're having a you got it. You're having a conversation. Right. And you're having it with your instruments.
You're talking back and forth and you're finding,
yeah,
right? Sort of collective voice.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys laid those things down pretty quickly, or was it a...
I'd say relatively quickly because, I mean, it's so long ago, you try to remember day by day. But I know all the recording was done for both Milk and Honey and Double Fantasy at one go.
Right.
Over a couple of month period.
Now, you know, one of the other things in terms of the dialogue, the album is very much this conversation between John and Milk.
Right.
And the songs speak to each other. Mm-hmm. Was that, were they finding that dialogue as well in the studio? Did they know the order of the tracks and stuff?
I'm not sure how much of that was put together when. You know, I mean, a lot of it was brought in relatively intact, lyrically.
Well, how would Yoko find her music? Was it the same as John? Was working through?
I don't know how she writes. I would imagine some on piano. She knew what she wanted when she got in there. So that, you know, however that was, it got done.
You know, Yoko is someone who I think is unfairly dismissed or derided, someone who's sort of, you know, this is a woman who worked with Ornette Coleman, you know, Eric Dolphy, two giants of jazz, who's, what is it about her musically that works for you? What is it about her that you found is surprising? I mean, you hadn't worked with her before at all.
No, no.
What was it that was surprising about her voice or about the tracks? I mean, I remember dancing to Kiss, Kiss, Kiss in college.
The thing about it was is her tracks were unusual. The form was unusual in a way, too. Is that, you know, you heard a song and it had to have this intro and then this verse and then this nice chorus and then this another verse and then this nice chorus and then a middle eight and then a little solo. And it didn't work like that. And then you'd have disco beats with her singing over them. And then me doing some kind of like off-the-wall shit behind that. And it was like, wow, I'm getting to do stuff. This is why I'm not a session player. If I tried to do this on one of those sessions that they call me in for, they would throw me out. And I'm perfectly at home here. This is wonderful.
Because
I heard a couple of pieces the other day, and I'm going, wow, it was cool.
And she's happy with that kind of like...
Yeah.
Right?
She requires it for her music. She does.
It's exactly right. So, as you're coming to the end of the sessions, what are you thinking to yourself, you know, I wish I'd done something a little bit different, you know, how did the thing start to wind down? Was Jack, that interplay, I'm just, you know, trying to figure out, like, how you knew Jack or John, how did you guys knew?
Well, we knew which of the songs were going to be Double Fantasy. And those were the ones that we worked on to get the overdubs done. And the rest, what was left, which turned into Milk and Honey later, was according to what my memory tells me, was that in 1981, early in the year, we were going to go back in the studio, finish the overdubs on that, and that would be another album. So as far as when Double Fantasy was done, it was obvious. It was winding down like any other, you know. All of a sudden, the guitar overdubs were being done and that stuff. And
but you're going to come back. This isn't the end.
No. It was the beginning. It was the beginning. It was the beginning of that record, then another record, and talking about doing a tour at the time with John. And
we're in a new band.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah.
Can you talk to me a bit about that sense, the John sense of possibility or John's sense of his future? I mean, he's not thinking, this is it, I'm going to put this one out, and then I'm done.
No, all I got from him was that he wanted the record out. He's excited about getting Double Fantasy out. And that he definitely wanted to do dates. Now, he wasn't specific. He said, I want to do a bunch of big cities. At the time, I had gotten... I was already signed to Columbia. And I was supposed to be in the studio doing my record while I was doing Double Fantasy. But they didn't mind. Because they figured, hey, if we jumpstart me on the back of Double Fantasy, it's not the worst thing in the world, right? So that was cool. And then the last conversation I had with John in person, face-to-face... was the day I left and finished the sessions, and he said, I'm on a tour next year, do you want to come? I said, I got to figure out what to do with Columbia. I said, I got a record to finish, and then they're going to want me to tour. He said, you want to come? That's what I'm asking you. I said, yes. He says, I'll take care of Columbia. I thought, all right, deal.
Yeah,
and that was the best thing he could have said to me. I walked out of that room like on cloud nine. That John Lennon thinks I'm cool enough that he's actually going to call my record company and tell him whatever he's going to tell him so he can, that I'm important enough to actually be in his band. It's.
Yeah. I'm going to tour with John.
Yeah.
Right?
And it wasn't like I hadn't been around. I mean, I already spent years with David Bowie and been in these situations when it was still not the same. Nothing, you know what I mean? It's where, this is where it comes from. You're at the source now, pal. Yeah.
There is that sense, and Jack talks about it too, and other people. I mean, literally starting over, not just him and Yoko, but he was. This was like, it's like the Beatles to 75 was like the first book or chapter or whatever, however you want to say it. This was the beginning of a whole new thing, right? I mean, did he have that kind of optimism?
He had a lot of optimism, a lot of energy. Looking forward to his future. You know, he was very optimistic. He was having a ball. He's like a little kid in a candy store. He was having a ball.
You know, I want to ask you again, and I know we did this a little bit, but I just want to get it a couple times in different takes. I apologize for it. How would, you know, would when you coming in, so Jack had gone through the basic tracks. Somebody's laid out the chord progressions on a piece of paper that you can't read. So how does John explain the song? Does he sit down and say, okay, boys, here's what we're doing today. Here's how I think it sounds. Does he play it out first for you guys? Give me the sense of what...
So if John wanted us to get the feel of the song, let me think about another one. If he wanted that, he'd play that. You guys, I want this. And, simple, right? Instead of some moron standing over the console for 30 minutes trying to explain when you could say it that fast, right? So that would, you know, or he would go, well, give me I need an Elvis thing on this, or Elvis bass, or, you know what I mean? He spoke in a language that we all understood. He couldn't look at the sheet music either, so we were both in the same boat. I think what they used to do for me is to write, like, on a piece of paper, E, A, B. That's it. And that's all I needed, though, because that's how I worked. I didn't understand how to do the other thing. I still don't.
But he doesn't. He never did.
No, he never did either.
Right. I think he said to Andy a couple times, and not quite this way, but the vibe was like, you know, play like Ringo here or something.
Yeah.
You know? So, you said goodbye to him in October or September? I don't know when the overdub sessions ended. The album was released in November, right?
I don't remember.
Yeah. Do you remember where you were December 8th, December 9th?
Yeah. I remember I'd spoken to him on the phone the night before.
Because he was still in the studio with
Yes,
Jack, right?
Yes. They were at Hit Factory doing something, walking on thin ice, I think. They were finishing some guitars or something. And this is why I don't do these things. I was in L.A., and it was a couple of weeks before Christmas. And at that point, I had my daughter was just a year old. And we were doing a Christmas shopping and getting ready to go back to New York to do the Italian family thing. And a friend of mine that grew up with Cole, he says, you hear what, John had an accident or something. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, put it on the news. I put it on TV. Hey, there's nothing on the news. And about, there must have been a delay between the, you know, not like now we're in this, you know, and the news story hit. And it was vague at first, but you could tell the way it hit that, something was like really bad. And then whenever it was, I forgot how many minutes it was that they made the announcement. And that's what I was doing. I was wrapping Christmas presents, getting ready to go to New York.
Did you believe it at first?
I don't know. I don't know. It was definitely one of those surreal moments where you're going, okay, this is a fucked up dream. I'm ready to wake up now. It was a weird moment. And then, you know, the after moments of it were even weirder because then all of a sudden all the shit started on the TV and then everything that happened after that for months, because you couldn't get away from it. I mean, unless you lock yourself in a room with no newspapers and no televisions.
A radio.
Everything was everywhere. And then me being in the band, the amount of phone calls I got for interviews and stuff, most of which I wouldn't go in. It just wasn't any... I had nothing to say, and everybody thought that was odd that I had nothing to say.
But you...
Somebody just shot my hero and my friend.
I'm sorry.
Somebody just shot my hero and my good friend. What the fuck do you think I'm going to tell you that's going to make you know anything that you didn't know from reading the damn news report? I got real angry and belligerent about it, and I wouldn't do interviews. Like I said, this is the first one that I've, agreed to do on camera in 30 years.
Why?
Jack. Jack said that this would be okay. So that's why.
Was anger the predominant feeling you had at that time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very angry. It was everything. You know, the whole thing was just so weird.
Stupid.
And then the difference of your hero that coming to an end like that you've been at a distance from via television and records to actually getting in the mix with the guy and have it happen. Now he's your friend. Now he's somebody you actually work with. And like any other friend of yours that would be taken away under those circumstances, your best friend, your mother, your father, your kid, whatever. All the horrible things that could happen. You know, and because I think that it having been one of my few rock and roll heroes, like I said, there's only been two of them. The other one is Keith. That to go down then, it was like, it was weird. Everything was just weird, and I was very angry about it.
Well, you know, I imagine part of it is that it makes no sense.
None.
What?
Not one ounce. But it's always the peaceful guys that get their heads blown off.
Up so there. Last question. What's the part of John you carry around with you? You were one of the lucky few to work with him. You worked on a great man. A moment when his voice is just as strong as it had ever been his whole life. So what do you carry around with you still?
Wow.
You have a little bit of John in your pocket?
All the time. I mean, I carry an odd memory here and there that makes me feel good, you know. And when I first did a box set that came out, 1999, the blue one.
The anthology, right?
Yeah. No, not the anthology. It was not. It was the Lennon box. It wasn't a Beatles box.
Right, Lennon anthology.
Right, yeah. And I think in one of the songs, right before my solo, I went and bought the thing and I put the CD on. And I hear John going, "Solo, Earl Slick." a grown man, 40-something years old at the time, and I'm rolling it over 50 times, and I'm listening to it, to hear John say my voice on this record that's, after all that time, and, you know, the thing that he gave me when I was a kid never went away. I still carry everything from the Ed Sullivan Show all the way up to the end. It's there. It's always there. The attitude, you know, the cockiness, the self-assuredness, the I don't give a f*** what you think thing, and the way he played his guitar communicates that. You know, even though the guy could write a wonderful love song to his wife, you know, on the other hand, he's, you know, he's... You know, it's cool.
Okay, cool.